Fantastic start, haven't we? It's been a very challenging vision Bill has given to us. Just a word of caution to us, because obviously those speakers coming onto the platform have been invited by the network. I don't want you to think that there's been a conspiracy to suggest there is one way of doing apologetics. For those of you who were here yesterday for the pre-hope seminar, you would have heard Elaine Storkey give what, as far as I'm concerned, was one of the best talks I've heard anywhere in a very long time, which offers a fantastic complement to many of the things Bill was saying. Now, it is great to know there are Elaine Storkeys and Bill Craigs and David Cooks. I sleep much sounder in my bed knowing that they're sort of getting out their boxing gloves and sorting out the big hitters in the secular world. But of course, there is much for us to do if we don't have those doctorates. And if we don't get those sorts of opportunities, in many ways, Bill's vision will provide the context, will provide a much more favorable setting in which we and our Christian brothers and sisters are going to see our family, our friends, our neighbors, our colleagues, those with whom we mix in social and working life. Those conditions that Bill longs to bring about are going to help us do the work of apologetics at that level. So if you felt in many ways you were either too old, beyond 35, or not academic enough, there is heaps for you to do with regard to apologetics. Now, I know there are many practitioners here, and the one thing you guys are all really interested in is communication, but I'm afraid we do need some analysis as well. I'm afraid the Brits are not very good at things European. They have a very poor grasp of European history, so I need to admit that now, and I'll give you an example of it. This is from a public examination paper. This is a young school child of 16 writing in a music exam about European composers. Now, let me just explain two terms. Spinster is a term in English for an unmarried woman, and spinneter, quite similar, spinster is a term for a type of piano. Listen to this exam paper. Yeah. Johann Bach wrote a great many musical compositions and had a large number of children. In between, he practiced on an old spinster, which he kept up in his attic. Bach died from 1750 to the present. Bach was the most famous composer in the world, and so was Handel. Handel was half German, half Italian, and half English. He was very large. Astonishing. That is genuine. That is genuine. So as somebody who went through that same system of education, I feel supremely unqualified to speak about the European context. Now, there are three questions we're going to ask that you'll see on the sheet. Where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? That's very suggestive, is it not, of Paul Gauguin's famous painting now hanging in Boston on this huge great wall. Where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? And these are the questions, aren't they, that we must answer if we're going to impact this generation and the one beyond it. Now, to help us answer those questions, who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? We need a theological perspective as well as an historical one. So I'd like you to turn with me to Mark 12. I think Gareth's been running a book on how long it would take me to get to the Bible. He's disappointed it's sooner rather than later. Mark chapter 12. Let's get something of the background to this. We've got the ruling class of Israel in front of Jesus. They're convinced that they are the spiritually enlightened ones, that they are the custodians of Israel's great past, and that they have the authority to carve out and direct Israel's future. And this is simply, right from the start, why they're in conflict with Jesus. Because he challenges their authority, doesn't he? Like the traffic policeman who says, "Right, for the traffic, you're not going that way anymore, go that way." That's what Jesus does from age 12. So you can imagine that they are in serious conflict with him. And this clash of authorities has reached a climax. Jesus has just cleansed the temple, and he could challenge their authority in no more striking form than that, could he? And they're incensed, and they ask him to answer for what he's doing. Who do you think you are? And so Jesus tells them in this passage I'm going to read to you where they've come from, who they are, and where they're going. And it's important that we notice their spiritual privilege and their hostility, not apathy, their hostility to the authority claim that God makes on them, initially through his prophets, but then through his son and heir. So let's read from verse 1. It's at this point I start my clock, crafty speaker that I am. He then began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the winepress, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. He sent still another, and that one they killed. He sent many others, some of them they beat, others they killed. He had one left to send, a son, whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, "They will respect my son." But the tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Haven't you read the scripture? The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. The Lord has done this, and it's marvelous in our eyes. Then they looked for a way to arrest him because they knew he'd spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away. So Israel is likened to a vineyard. They would recognize this story, the audience from Isaiah 5. It's not a complimentary story. It's about the rebellion and the societal decay of ancient Israel, the original Isaiah 5 version. It's interesting, isn't it? Jesus doesn't start in his story of where they've come from, who they are, where they're going, with Roman oppression and Jewish suffering, but with their rejection of God. They're reminded, in no uncertain terms, verse 1, they are but tenant farmers. They don't own Israel, they're just tenants. The landlord has gone on a journey, and this is always an excuse, isn't it, for a society to rebel against God. And in verses 2 to 5, they're told of their history of rebellion and hostility against their landlord and the claims he makes on them. Now, it's worth noticing that these Old Testament messengers, apologists, prophets, they went to Israel. They did two things. One, they defended God's name. They kept saying, "God has not stopped caring about you. He's not an absentee landlord. He brought you out of Egypt. Look what he's done for you, like a loving father." And not only did they defend God's name, but they prosecuted unbelief. "You brought about the exile you're now in. You were spat out of God's land by your own wickedness." And I believe that not only was that the twin responsibility of the prophet then, but it is the responsibility of the apologist now, to clear God's name and to prosecute unbelief. Now, that's very easy to say, but boy, is that demanding. We need three things if we're going to do that. We need to have a big view of God, don't we? We need a big view of God and his glory to do a ministry like this, which will always create hostility when understood. Do you remember Paul in Athens, Acts 17, 16? He was provoked, deeply angry, stirred at the idolatry he saw in front of him, which is why, verse 17, he reasoned. He didn't roll his sleeves up and get reasoning in the agora and then at the invitation in the Areopagus until he was provoked for God's glory. The second thing that's needed is a willingness to suffer, which again is intrinsic in this story. Look what happened to God's apologists of the Old Testament: seized, beaten, sent away empty-handed. It's been a fruitless exercise for many of them. And some were treated shamefully and killed. And thirdly, it's about a loyalty to Christ. This defending God's name and prosecuting unbelief as his apologists is all about loyalty to Christ. That's where we should get our motivation and our energy and our joy. Because what the tenants are really after is God's Son. They want the heir of the vineyard dead. If God's on his journey, they can do what they like. The messengers come and go. They can be seen off. They can be intimidated. But when the Son and heir comes, that's really bad news. They can't anymore pretend that they're in charge when he makes a claim on them. So what's the solution? Well, look at verses 7 and 8. Weren't they just chilling when I read them? Even more chilling, knowing that within a matter of days, this group were actually going to enact this very story. That's what's so electric about this. These people are just days away from seizing Jesus, shamefully treating him. And they don't just send him away empty-handed, but they strip him naked and thrust him up in God's face, saying, "Have your son back. We don't want him to rule over us." Now you might say, what has this ancient story of Israel got to do with us? Well, this is what Europeans, what Europe has done in the past, and it's what Europeans would do today, given half a chance. That is the default mode of human nature when they really understand the claims of God's Christ upon them. Fallen human nature hates God's authority. Now, quite simply, this is not any Israel story, but Europe's story, simply because it's the story of the human race. It was first told in Genesis 2 and 3, wasn't it? Adam started life as a tenant farmer. He had a wonderful existence, but he was not in charge. This was not his garden, was not his world. There was an authority situation. Yeah, enjoy it, do as you like, apart from this one thing. But no, he wasn't satisfied with that. He wanted the knowledge of good and evil. He wanted this to be his world. He wanted to be in control. Resisting authority and placing it with the tenant farmers is what human nature always wants to do. Philip Pullman, I don't know how many of you have read his Dark Materials trilogy. Yeah, okay, not that many. They're selling in their millions now, and he's just sold the film rights for £10 million. And there are going to be three of them coming out, the first one in about 3 years. And he grew up hating C.S. Lewis's Narnia so much that this has been a motivation in him writing a view of the fall in all sorts of situations, showing how to kill God, to deliberately rebel against him, is the right thing for humans to do. I was talking to a philosopher, a colleague of David Green's at Green College a few weeks ago, and I said, why is it that Pullman hates Lewis so much? And he said, well, most of Oxford hates Lewis so much because he really got under people's skin. And the dastardly thing he did was to trick people into reading Narnia, into loving it, thinking they're reading a nice story. They get to the last battle and they realize they've bought into a whole worldview where the human race goes left and right, saved and unsaved. That is unforgivable. C.S. Lewis wasn't content with just merely being a good Christian academic. No, he actually took the battle to those around him. And Oxford has never forgiven him. The snobbery, the hatred of Lewis is palpable. But that's another story. And of course, all this, because this is where the battle lines are drawn, this is why much of the media, the intelligentsia, and the ruling classes hate the gospel. In a way, they don't hate Buddhism. And even, surprisingly, they don't hate Islam. Deep down, they know what they're reacting against. The divorce, as we heard yesterday, C.S. Lewis tells us, was between Europe and Christianity. Far easier to introduce two potential lovers, even if the match is exotic and from a slightly different context. That is easier than trying to introduce two people who've divorced and don't quite understand the conditions, don't have a proper memory of it, but think it didn't work, we mustn't go there again. Now, we've really got to take this on board, that men and women are in rebellion against God, and whether you're reading Romans or the Gospels, given half a chance, they would kill God's Christ. Now, that's where God starts the story. We could, of course, in looking at the European context, start with the lostness, the hopelessness of society, which we must do, and we must do that well. But we've got to be careful, haven't we? If we start with Israel's story, at the exile, we just feel sorry for them. We begin to sort of be on their side. What is God playing at? But the New Testament never tells their story that way, never tells it in a sentimental, man-centered way. They are in exile because way back they rejected God's authority. Now, I think it's vital in our telling, in our understanding of Europe's story, that we properly factor in the fall, this attempt to arrest authority from God, and the human depravity and the misery that flows from that. And that's not to say we don't then care about the resulting despair that comes from it, but that theologically must be where we start and we actually get our convictions. So let's notice three things. Just before we do, when am I finishing? I'm not very good at looking at my own clock. Whilst you pray about that. Oh. The whole session. Okay. So 11:44 will do nicely. Okay. Three things to notice. Just like first century Europe, Israel, sorry, just like Israel, Europe has had a privileged past. We got that out eventually, didn't we? And we'll observe, as in Mark, that this involves both the rejection of authority and the judgment of God. Now again, way back when the Roman Empire fell across Europe, the Christian church stood her ground and converted the invading tribes. The Celtic church from the north and the Roman church from the south converted the Angles, Saxons and the Jutes who came to England. And they in their turn converted the invading Danes. It's the only thing to do with these fierce Scandinavians. You've got to convert them. And it wasn't long before all the peoples of Europe adopted the Christian faith. And just as Israel's teachers assumed control while God was on his journey, in the Middle Ages, it was undoubtedly the medieval church who assumed the unquestioned authority over God's vineyard over Europe. And as with Israel's prophets, these leaders treated God's apologists, the reformers, very, very badly. They were shamefully treated, many were murdered, as we know. If you go to the city where I work, Oxford, and visit the Martyrs Memorial, you'll see the memorial, and if you go around the corner on Broad Street, you can stand in the very spot where men like Latimer, Ridley, Cranmer were literally burnt by the church for trying to arrest authority back to God and his Christ. But it was arguably the expulsion of the Huguenots from France that provided the most shocking snapshot of what man will do to resist this authority claim. Streets literally ran with blood. But of course, by God's mercy, this blood was the seed of the Reformation, and Europe was changed. The church was reformed, and society, in large measure, was renewed. And it's great to know that that all began with a European apologetic network, otherwise known as the Reformation. And it was a European network. John Wycliffe, an Englishman, who was the first reformer, and then Jan Hus, a Czech, and then Martin Luther, a German, Ulrich Zwingli, a Swiss, and then John Calvin, a Frenchman. And through their tireless battles with the church, a large measure of authority was transferred back to God's Christ and heir through obedience to the gospel. Now that's wonderfully encouraging, isn't it? It has been done in history. Okay, the conditions were there. There was a church to be reformed. The structures were there. And it's totally different now. In many ways, a much harder job. But it has been done before. But not without appalling suffering and cost. The apologists of the Reformation, I'm pleased to tell you, were not ultimately sent home empty-handed. Many died. But the grip of the church was seized apart, and by the agencies of the proclamation of the gospel, the persuasive proclamation of the gospel and the refutation of error. And it's really important for us to realize we can't do one without the other. And we'll come back to that theme, no doubt, later on, if not in the questions. Because if we only do one, if we only proclaim the gospel and do not refute error, as Luther said, we're merely professing Christ. We are not confessing him. And so Europe began to get a taste of the good life, what society could begin to look like under God's Christ, under his authority. And the great legacy, of course, of the magisterial reformers like Luther, Calvin and Cranmer was that they related the gospel to the whole of society, to politics and education. Now, I don't know about your context. I certainly know from talking to friends in Norway that, and obviously in the UK, that pietism makes this very suggestion very badly regarded by many Christians. In some of our most impressive UK churches, many Christians are suspicious of apologetics. This earth is going to be burnt up and destroyed. Why bother trying to get into the universities? and do philosophy better? Why be interested in politics and education and so on and so forth? And because most of the evangelism with our churches happens with the fringe, the people who are close enough to church to go through a 10-week or a 3-month course, that gets reinforced. People say, I don't need big apologetics. Because every time I do evangelism, which is invariably in those sorts of settings for lots of people, I don't need it. And of course, the moment we do begin to do serious apologetics, we get the hard nuts in. And what feeds back to us is this: hang on, I'm doing apologetics, and what I'm doing is I'm getting hostility. Therefore, I should have gone back to the simple proclamation of the gospel. No. If you just do the simple proclamation of the gospel, you won't have the non-Christians at your event in the first place. Not least because the Christians won't have the confidence to bring them. When I started my new job in Oxford 18 months ago, it's a large church, has a lot of university faculty at it, I was announced as the director of evangelism. And some very well-meaning academics came up to me and said, Richard, a word of advice, evangelism doesn't work here. Thank you very much, that's most encouraging. And what they meant by that was epilogue evangelism doesn't work. It's too dishonest to have an otherwise enjoyable event like wine tasting or a barbecue and then somebody get up saying, Jesus died for you, and don't judge a bottle by its label or something like that. They said, we can't bring our academic friends, senior civil servants, the Oxford Writing Set, we can't bring them to that. So we're going to be a witness to Christ by how we do our work, a whole Protestant work ethic. Now, one of the things we did as a response to that over the past 8 months, we've put on some events that actually make it plausible for friends to be brought. So the first one I organised was with the Permanent Secretary of State for Northern Ireland and a convicted terrorist. They're two different people, they're not the same. Sir Joe Pilling will be after me, along with the Secret Service. And we had the most powerful evening, looking at the explanatory power of Christianity to see this situation, and of course the transforming power, not just informing the Permanent Secretary of State in how he goes about his job, but taking a hardened bomber and making it so he not only could no longer kill Catholics, but that he was forced into loving them. And non-Christians came, I mean, Oxford just came out in their masses. Here was something that wasn't cringy, wasn't bolt-on. But in doing that and stuff with David Cook on the moral maze and various other things with economists and Barks and Matthew Passion explaining the story behind that, and I'm doing a debate with Philip Pullman in a few weeks' time, the result of that is we're getting the hard nuts along. And the moment you get the hard nuts along, you find you need apologetics big time. Is our responsibility only to the 4% who are on the fringe of our church? Do we not have some responsibility to the 90% of our neighbours, friends, colleagues, who will come nowhere near a course, who will come nowhere near the fringe? Well, obviously it's got to be. But of course, the battle is with the church and not just the society in which we live. Now, I want to quickly move on from this because my time's going, but it's worth noting that those countries which were most influenced by the Reformation, Scandinavia, Germany, Netherlands, Switzerland, they led the way, not least for the New World, in promoting trade, wealth and stability. Now, although Europe, over the past, 10, 15 years, has been overtaken by North America and Southeast Asia, much of that momentum came from the Protestant worldview. Now, most seriously of all, is that this continent of ours that became the launching pad, not just for prosperity and democracy, but also for worldwide missions. And yet, it's declined spiritually over the past 250 years. While in contrast, much of the rest of the globe that's been industrialized has flourished spiritually. European exceptionalism, it's called. Why has Europe declined into secular humanism? I suppose most striking is that at the beginning of the 20th century, while some of the greatest modern missions were taking place across the world, that Europe, the catalyst for these missions, descended into barbaric slaughter. In 1914, millions of European citizens marched under their own national flags to fight one another to the death. 50 million in both world wars, 50 million Europeans killed each other. Astonishing, isn't it? It's a curious and a perplexing story that the cradle of Western civilization, the center of the Reformation, and the seedbed of democracy could be so prone to nationalism, fascism, tyrannical Marxism and the mass slaughters that went with them. How could such a rich Christian heritage be spent up in such a brutal secular fashion? Now, since we're apologists here, we believe, don't we, in the power of ideas, and not just good ones, but bad ones. And under the heading, an embattled church and a decaying society, we can, of course, trace this decline to the Enlightenment, the modernist project, the deliberate rejection of the Christian worldview that God had ever spoken. Now, it's very important that we do remind ourselves that the epicenter of this was Europe, France, and then spread out to everyone else. Postmodernism is but a thin veneer on top of this much, much greater revolution. We heard about the Romantics, but now the certain strands of postmodernism are still being defined by this revolution, the Enlightenment, and we mustn't lose sight of that. Now, there's a quote from Paul Hazard there. In the light of what was said in Mark 12, just look at this as we consider this revolution of the Enlightenment in creating a world order. Hazard suggests that it actually was so hostile to God's Christ that it deliberately set about to destroy the belief in divine revelation. He says in his introduction, "Rich and weighty as were the legacies bequeathed to us by old Greece and Rome, by the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, the fact remains that it's the 18th century of which we're the direct and lineal descendants. The philosophers openly preferred a charge, the like of which, for sheer audacity, had never before been heard of. The culprit was dragged into open court, and behold, the culprit was Christ. It was more than a reformation which the 18th century demanded, it was the total overthrow of the cross, the utter repudiation of the belief that man had ever received a divine communication from God, a repudiation of the belief in revelation. What the critics were determined to do was to destroy even the religious interpretation of life." Boy, we just almost need to pause, don't we? Just to feel the hatred of that. Denis Diderot, the French encyclopedist, summarized this hostility to the Christian worldview when he said this, quote, "I hope for the day when the last king would be strangled by the entrails of the last priest." And if we take this story of Jesus in Mark 12 seriously, as I'm sure we do, we will not be surprised or shocked at this. The gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ will always be hated by sinful human beings who long to gain freedom from a higher authority and take the inheritance to themselves. The gospel, God's claim upon people's lives, will be a savour of life to those being saved. But to those who are not, it will be the stench of death. And there are two headings here, freedom and reason and science. This is all pretty self-explanatory, but it is entirely consistent with the spirit of the Enlightenment. The tenant farmer storming the Bastille and murdering the king and heir to his and the heir to claim that very inheritance. There was a great sense of there was going to be liberty, equality, fraternity. This is Israel's story, this is Europe's story, this is our story. And when you see that line from Wordsworth in the notes, you get a sense of how much they enjoyed their freedom from God and his Christ. "One impulse from a vernal wood may teach you more of man, of moral evil and of good than all the sages can." Is it any surprise that a century ago, the Danish philosopher, the theologian Søren Kierkegaard said Europeans were, quote, "baptized pagans, Christianized but not properly evangelized." And one of the justifications for announcing this new freedom, for pronouncing God dead, was reason and science. Science is a better master. Unlike God, he doesn't go off on a long journey. Science actually does some repairs. Science makes things work. Science makes our living conditions better. God doesn't. And since there aren't so many gaps in our knowledge, we don't need him anymore. And then there's a quote from John Roberts talking about the new priesthood of scientists. "There are more scientists alive and working at this moment in history than have ever lived and died in the whole of human history. All this explains why science is a major religion, perhaps the religion of our civilization. For most men and women, science is one of the few remaining verities. It is sometimes the only one to which a post-Christian European admits any allegiance. Now, I know those of us who've seen the emergence of postmodernism might find that comment a little stylized. It's worth realizing that the image makers of the 19th and early 20th century were totally intoxicated by all that science could do. They'd seen the authority shift from God to the church. They'd seen it go now from church to the scientists, and if anybody wanted to sell anything, they'd put a guy in a white coat, claim he was a scientist, and say, this is scientifically proven. This was the new authority. But of course, the optimism, the hope of freedom, of progress, the inevitable progress that was predicted, led to despair. Those enchanting cries of liberty, equality, and fraternity, which spread with the Enlightenment, they would eventually suffocate the whole of Europe with a fog of such existential despair. It would have just seemed unbelievable to the Enlightenment philosophers. And it's striking that when Gauguin painted his famous picture, he did so at a transition in his own life. He loathed the complexity and the prescriptive nature of the modernist project. He wanted to find the noble savage. He wanted to find a less complex way of doing life. And when he painted his picture, where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? He immediately drank arsenic to try and kill himself. As one Sunday Times art critic says, and it's in your notes, about this painting, it's composed with the precision of a Cézanne, but filled with doubt. In the title, he asked the ultimate questions and did not stay for an answer. Why? There isn't one. Isn't that enough to make us weep? But there's a man who gets that close. He's asking the big, big questions. But he just assumes that the Enlightenment view has been correct in removing the church. He hates the world it's given him, but there are no longer answers. And then the modern pessimism and despair spreads right into culture, as Schaeffer suggested, from science to philosophy, from philosophy to art, from art to music, and then into general culture, and then at some point into theology, where the clerics think, now what is it our constituency can believe today, and how shall we shape our message? But that's how it works. Now there's some stuff I could say about giants of unbelief, about the philosophical skepticism and the ethical relativism that was reflected in literature, in legislation and behaviour, the emergence of Darwinism. But time doesn't permit. But just to say, all this was seriously questioned. The intelligentsia, of course, were secular, long before the masses, but with the shock of the Great War and the Great Depression of the 30s, belief in God continued its decline. You'd think it would wake them up to their need of God, but it didn't. And then we have secular humanism with the inevitability of progress. Now, it would be strange, wouldn't it, if we're looking at the backdrop of Europe, not to mention socialism. Now, the First World War, astonishingly, didn't make the majority of ruling classes doubt their views about the perfectibility and the moldability of human nature. They largely believed their own socialist claim that since suffering and evil were the result of inadequate social conditions, they would just change those conditions, just have new conditions. And who's going to create these conditions? The family? No, far too selfish. Obviously not the church. It has got to be put into the hands of the state. And we might still ask ourselves, how could vast swathes of Europe, after the Great War, how could they become dominated by socialism, by communism, by secular humanism? Well, quite simply, the power of ideas. This throwback to Rousseau's idea of the noble savage. And what's the result of all this? Of killing God and making man the measure of all things? Well, Schaeffer tells us that when we make us the measure of all things, man as man is dead. And the question Camus put at the end of the Second World War is still a question for us. The kingdom of grace has been conquered, but the kingdom of justice is crumbling too, and Europe is dying in the deception. So where does this leave us? Where does this leave us? Well, where do we come from? Who are we going? I think in reality Europeans don't know too much about that, the secular Europeans, they're not that interested. We have a rich history. And they know even less about who they are, where they're heading. We talk a lot about our past, but one of the reasons for ambivalence about our future is because we've become pessimistic. Now, why has it been that with all the failure of the secular project, of the modernist project, why is it that we haven't reacted against it? And why is it that we're so peculiarly vulnerable, as we see with the rise of fascism at the moment in France? Well, Fred Cathwood's very helpful on this. He suggests that secular humanism just has no inherent capacity to demand our loyalty. For starters, it's very humorless, isn't it? Do you know any good humanist comedians? I haven't heard too many. And if you've ever debated with humanists, you'll see what Fred Cathwood's getting at. It's so dull and sterile and humorless that it leaves those who breathe its air vulnerable to the more vigorous winds of nationalism. It creates an authority vacuum. And most Europeans do not actually really commit to secular humanism. They don't have a love or a loyalty for it, just as most of the friends I have, non-Christian friends, don't particularly want their children to grow up as homosexuals. They want them to get married and produce the next generation so they can have grandchildren. And yet, even the ordinary people do not really commit to these politically correct views. It's very hard to say them. Just on the Times flying over, there was detail of a preacher in England who'd just been fined for preaching against homosexuality. And the person concerned said, "I felt intimidated." But when you read the small print, you realise that this open-air preacher was being pelted with bottles and mud by a crowd of 40. But of course, the politically correct will say, "We're being intimidated. This is a power game." And when a Jean-Marie Pen speaks in public, the intelligentsia rightly put him down. They don't believe he has a right even to hold this view, and people have no right to vote for him with this view. But ordinary people are fed up, aren't they? They're fed up with moral relativism and what it looks like as far as they're concerned, drugs and violence on the street. Look at the decay we've got from moral relativism. So fed up with being bullied by the politically correct intelligentsia that 40% of French voters vote for a fascist with such appalling views. And this has been Europe's story time and time again. Humanism can be swept away very quickly, as Mussolini, Hitler and Franco proved, because secular humanism is bankrupt. It has no capacity to command the support of ordinary people. And this is the price our continent has paid for crucifying Christ 250 years ago. And we have got to speak up against this secularism, against this humanism. We've got to show how bankrupt it's left us. And we've got to ask people to put their allegiance and their loyalty in God and his Christ. And may the Lord raise up people here to do that at all levels, to our families, to those of us who are educators, in the media, and so on and so forth. Well, so much for the past. We need to ask a little bit more in our final minutes. How should we address the modern European? To whom is our apologetic directed? I put the heading there, suspicion and disillusionment. We're very familiar, aren't we, with the suspicion of meta-narratives of big institutions, whether they're the church, the communists, the modern nation state with multinational backing. But in being suspicious of these big institutions, again, it hasn't created a sense of hunger for the God and Father of Jesus Christ, but it's created the cult of self-love. We just only trust ourselves now. The self is the last site of control, and narcissism is everywhere. And this resulting neurosis we get from narcissism, this reaction against others telling us how to live, is probably more acute at our moment than at any other point in human history. Now, this shift from modern to postmodern, who is the hardest to reach? I think one of the best films for showing this clash is Jodie Foster in the film Contact. Totally improbable film, good movie. Jodie Foster, hard-bitten, modernist scientist, wants to represent the human race to meet this superior alien life form. I told you it's improbable. But why is she disqualified? Because she doesn't believe in God. I'm a scientist, she says. And in the film, she's made to seem like a total dinosaur for saying that. And of course, later on, she has a spiritual experience. In spite of all the evidence, she says, I know I had it. It's true for me. And sad person that I am, I was asking myself, having watched that film, who would be the easiest person to reach with the gospel? The sort of secular, scientific Jodie Foster, or the postmodern spiritual Jodie Foster. Certainly, it'd be very hard to even get a conversation with a secular scientist. Oh, go away. I've no time for your rubbish. But my hunch is that the postmodern Jodie Foster, while she'd be more than willing to talk about spirituality, she would be just as hard, if not harder, to reach. And I'm finding that with the university missions I take. That as year on year, I take these missions. Lots of people talk spirituality. They're all dressed up with nowhere to go, somebody said. And they don't want to commit to anywhere. It's great to talk about it, great to share our story. But to commit to one absolute truth is utterly ridiculous. People are bored and exhausted in keeping up with the pace and the complexities of modern life, but they are strikingly reluctant to commit to anything that demands their loyalty as the gospel does. Now, two features of postmodernism, we can talk about this in questions, but just quickly, globalism and tribalism. Now, among the wealthy nations of the West and the Pacific Rim, there's the elitist march to further globalization. Globalization of products and economic control. CNN and MTV, broadcasting 24 hours, news, pop, music videos. And most of the students I work with feel a greater allegiance to MTV than they do to their national governments. Now, technology multiplies at an enormous pace, and there's still the prevalent hope amongst some that science and reason will save the world, with consumerism being the dominant ideology. Now, that's one feature of our postmodern society, globalization. The other, and perhaps the more pervasive response to the crisis of modernism, is tribalism. And this is true not only amongst the poorer nations who have fewer resources to pursue technological distractions and solutions, but obviously among the Arab countries, we see a desire to return to religious and cultural fundamentalism. The rise of the Euro-fascist and right-wing politics. They give evidence to the tremendous need for people to gather around them, those who articulate a sense of cultural identity. We long to belong somewhere, don't we? Did you read, I think last week, it was an American story, about a lesbian couple in the States who just had a big celebration that their three-month-old daughter is now clinically deaf. And it was no accident. They're a deaf couple, and they asked for a sperm donor who had a history going way back of deafness in the family. And the Washington Post quotes their justification. We wanted to share the wonderful aspects of our deaf community with our children. People need to belong. They need to know which tribe to join. Are we homosexual, disabled, black, upper class, academic, white, British? Now, these communities are all very well, but they make the possibility of universals far harder. And the interesting thing about globalization and tribalism happening at the same time, it means the world is both coming together and fragmenting like never before. And that's a very strange phenomenon. And maybe some of you guys can articulate something of that a bit more in questions. The writer Benjamin Barber describes this phenomenon as McWorld versus Jihad. And that's never been more striking than after 9/11, September the 11th. So very quickly for our final thoughts. Will we fall into the black hole of multinational control, or are we going to be caught up in the whirlwind of desperate holy wars for cultural identity? These are important questions, aren't they? Postmodernism isn't particularly idealistic. Stanley Grentz calls it annoying pessimism, eating away at the structures of societies. It's an age without hope, as Stuart spelled out so magnificently and movingly yesterday. Now, there is a danger, obviously, in when we see the lostness of our society, that we only deal with the contact points, and we must deal with those contact points. But at some point, the battle for ideas has got to be faced and has got to be won. And we have got to make a start at winning those battles, that even though we can't necessarily know absolutely, totally, we can know truly. And as we do our apologetics in a postmodern world, I've just listed a couple of false moves. I haven't got time to develop them now. You can ask in questions if you wish. Truth versus relevance. Postmoderns don't want to know whether it's true. They want to know whether it's relevant, whether it works. Of course, it is only the truth that works. It's only the truth that's relevant. Guys my age, they want to know whether they can bring their kids up on something. They are actually asking, can I trust this? Is it true? They don't necessarily use those categories. Reason versus experience. For some, we must give them our experience, and for others, we must give them reason. Again, it's an unhelpful distinction that we could develop in questions. We need to meet people, as Elaine told us, where their experience is at, but then appeal to them through persuasion, through argument, to come in line with where God wants them. And if this is going to happen significantly, we need flexibility. I think that is the biggest thing we need in a postmodern age. It's not that we want just experience and we want just relevance. We need flexibility like never before. Paul in 1 Corinthians 9:27 talks about the whole discipline of his life. He flexes. He's with the Greek, the barbarian, the Jew, the Gentile. He will adopt his deportment, his language, whether he's speaking to Jews in a synagogue or Athenians at their ruling council. He'll shift from Bible to Greek poetry and philosophy. But it's a sacrificial and selfless life to discipline ourselves to do that. One of the striking situations I found myself in that told me the need for this flexibility, I was fairly new into the house I now live in. I got together some of the men in our village. I chatted to them because I was a clergyman helping in the local parish church. They would see me in my silly robes, you know, in important occasions, all the rest of it. I thought it was a really important thing for us to thrash out Christianity. I'm not just the strange asexual being who floats around in a robe, but I actually believe something. So I told them the gospel as best I knew. And I used the vehicle of my story because I thought that would be a good way. I just sort of told them what I believed. And you can say all sorts of outrageous things if it's your story. And of course, you know, I learned when I was considering Christianity that if I didn't believe this, I was going to be judged and going to hell. And but that was fine. That was my story. And they heard it and they nodded and they appreciated it. And they said, Richard, that's terrific. Is this what you tell students? That's great. They really need to hear this. People really... I thought, what is going on here? Have they heard a word I've said? So I thought I'd just sort of slightly flex and recast what I've said and use different categories and talk in terms of public truth, not just my story, my experience. And the result was amazing. Within 5 minutes that we have a saying, the penny dropped, people realized immediately what I was on. And there was a sudden surge of noise so great as people started shouting at me. These are just nice guys from the village. People started shouting at me. My wife, two floors up, came down into the kitchen thinking, I've got to stop this. You know, these guys are married to my best friends. We'll be outcasts in the village. And she expected to find us beating each other up, which, of course, metaphorically, we were doing. And when she satisfied herself, this was just good male bonding, she left the kitchen. We had a few more beers. But it was only at that moment we were really understanding the issues. And do you know what? When they understood that I was really meaning this, I was really saying this, exclusive claims of Christ, judgment, etc., etc., they said, but Jesus would never say that. That's not what Jesus says. So funnily enough, we find ourselves flexing to the straightforward proclamation. So we had a look at what Jesus said. I got out a Bible. And do you know where they went from there? They were cornered. They said, but who believes the Bible? So we're flexing now to an evidential apologetic that we're told we don't need anymore. And they're saying, well, I suppose, yeah, if it wasn't written by Peter's granny, if it has been accurately transmitted, maybe that is what Jesus said. But that doesn't feel right for me. And you see the need to flex. And Paul tells us we need to make this our way of life. Now, finally, there are a few headings there. Authenticity and community. If we have no absolute truth, then we have no core, no center. And all that's left is appetite. Because there are no convictions anymore. We heard a shocking example of that with American Psycho in the afternoon seminar yesterday. But people are so hungry, therefore, for anything with authenticity, with integrity. For people to come into our homes and share a meal with our family and to see how we talk to each other, to come into our churches, the opportunity to show the authenticity, the integrity, the community of our families, of Christian churches, is a great, great opportunity like never before. Like never before. But, warning, we must not confuse assimilation of the needy, lost non-Christian into the body of the church where they enjoy the friendship and the lack of cynicism and they're perfectly willing to put up with singing our songs and even praying our prayers. We dare not confuse assimilation with conversion, with facing the authority claim of God's Christ and making that decision for themselves. And there's also danger. It's a huge opportunity, but the danger with that opportunity we must be aware of. And three final points. To be the confessing church, we need identification, prosecution, and invitation. In terms of identification, we must identify with people, but also identify where they are. What are the false presuppositions? What authority is it that they are subscribing to? When Luther spoke of the confessing church, he said this. He said, if we fight the battle in any other place and where it rages most fiercely, then we don't confess Christ with the whole of our vigor and our lives and our lifestyle. We merely profess him. It's just words. Now, he had to locate where the authority struggle lay then. For him, it was the church. Now, later it became the authority shifted to the scientist. Now, if we're just doing an apologetic against scientism and materialism, we're not really, for most people, going to be confessing Christ, are we? It'll be stylized. People say, well, I don't have any real allegiance to that. Maybe there are a few fundamentalist Darwinians, but that's not me. So where is the authority now? Christ has been murdered. He's out of the vineyard. So who's now in charge? It's not the church. It's not the scientists. Who is it now? It's us, isn't it? It's our sensibilities. Postmodernism isn't humble. It isn't noble. It isn't spiritual. All we've done is we've shifted the site of human control from reason to our sensibilities. And boy, the people hold that authority seriously and dearly. So we must identify where people are at, and we must prosecute. We must expose the falseness of their claim to authority. It's not enough for Luther to just say, Christ died for our sins. By grace are we saved through faith. No. Luther, if he'd have just said that, his monks would have heard grace. Yeah, big reservoir of grace piped down through the seven sacraments of the church. Luther would be merely professing. No, Luther took his sledgehammer and said, by grace, but let me just do some damage. And so he smashed the entire apparatus. He says, you cannot get it by these means. This is false. And by prosecuting, of course, he nearly lost his life. You identify what is false, you prosecute what is false, but lastly, we invite people to embrace the truth at a given point of what Christ offers. And more significantly, it's not just the truth that he offers, a worldview, but it's a relationship with the King. As Greg reminded us yesterday, the early church outlived, outthought, and outdied or outsuffered the pagans. And we've just got to be ready for the suffering. Because it is the reasonableness of our faith, as you'll see wonderfully. Randall Macaulay pointed this out to me years ago, Acts 26:22. It's just the most wonderful passage. Paul is before Festus and he gives a reasonable explanation for his faith. And do you know how Festus responds? You're out of your mind. And what does Paul say? Most excellent, Festus, I'm not out of my mind. What I say is true and reasonable and is known to King Agrippa. You know these things to be true, don't you? And Agrippa says, do you think in such a short time you can persuade me? It is the reasonableness, the sense that this claim is serious. This cannot just be ridiculed. It is the reasonableness, the persuasion of our apologetic that will trigger the hostile reaction and that will make people hate us as they hated and hate C.S. Lewis. And we must invite them to come and embrace the capstone, the whole myth of Solomon's temple was there was this stone, they didn't know what to do with it. And then they found it was the capstone. Christ is the capstone. Out of loyalty to him, let's outlive, outthink, and outsuffer our society and invite them to this wonderful Christ and this wonderful gospel. I've gone over time, I'm sorry, but that means I only have 10 minutes to suffer at your hands, which is no bad thing. Stefan, do you want me to suggest they have... Okay, we'll take questions straight away then.
Okay.
Questions or comments, and I must remember to repeat them. Yeah.
I wonder whether you could elaborate on one point. I was struck by the analogy of McWorld versus jihad. The more as I have been speaking, talking a couple of days ago with a fellow called Jihad. Ka'a Valley, close to the Hezbollah village, survived. But there is a point which connects your lecture with that of Dr. Craig, in that he actually suggested that there would be one of those tribes which would be particularly accessible for Christian truth, and that would be a university. And could you elaborate a bit more on the various tribes? Because it is true, here you have academics, there's youth cultures, plural, not just one youth culture. Here's the gay community, here's the elitarian society, part of society. So how can we pervade these various tribes with the gospel? You might
Yeah, thank you very much. The question is the tribalism one. In a fast-growing, multi-conformist culture in terms of the whole consumerism and technology that's around us, what are the tribes and how do we reach them in any specialist way, in any effective way? I think we could multiply tribes in all sorts of ways. But just to say why I believe we have gone tribal, it is, of course, because there is no universal, and yet people need to belong. They are made in God's image. They know that this is not just a chance hostile universe. Somehow they need to know where they've come from, who they are, where they're going. Where will they find that identity? They crave that identity. People without fathers crave to find their fathers. They need to know who they are. And one of the safest ways of doing that is to find people who have certain distinctives, whether they're sexual, whether it's to do with handicap or colour or religious belief or interest. The whole dangerous sports brigade and the snowboarders and everybody else. People increasingly want to be in small communities. They want some control over their lives again, some identity. They want to downsize, get away from complexity and just have some kind of community, some kind of space in which they can say, yeah, this is me. I know who I am. One of the suggestions by some very effective youth workers in Britain is for Christians to go and become members of those tribes. Obviously not the gay community, nor the Muslim community in that sense, but to go and be part of, so if it's the whole rave culture, the dance culture, which is huge tribalism for many of our young people who cut themselves and pierce their bodies and only subscribe to a certain form of dance music, that is one way to incarnate, to get close enough to them, to meet them where they're at, to move them to where God wants them. And other of the house churches deliberately plant, they say to members of their congregation, go and live on that estate and go to that pub with those people, join that football team, become part of people's tribes. And to be honest, if the church doesn't become community, if we don't start walking to church, and I'm a hypocrite in this, having walked to church for the past 8 years, I'm now driving some 30 minutes to church. If we don't start living in the same place for a good period of 10 years so we can meaningfully become part of people's tribes, I don't see how without that community, without that either drawing people into our community or having contacts in their tribe, I don't know how we're going to reach the 90% who are way back. That's a long answer. Maybe there's so many experts here, maybe some applications. Is this about this? Yeah.
I see the danger also in our Christian community that there are many tribes. For example, when I look at the students' movement, IPS, for example, I can see that a lot of students are not involved in local churches anymore, but feel well in the students' movement and have their community there. And it's the same with charismatic and evangelical and so on. People who rather want to stress their feelings and so on rather try to go to charismatic churches. Other people who rather like the traditional way of service go to the free churches, the brethren churches and so on. And I can see this at least in Germany. I don't know about the other
churches. Yeah, very much in the UK. Yeah.
The same tribalism is in Christian communities.
But for those listening to the tape, tribalism is just as true in the church. Yeah, thank you. There and then at the back.
Back to the since he said the global versus jihad.
Yeah.
From your perspective, how do you view Islam, both worldwide and in the West?
Mm-hmm.
Do you view it as just one tribe among many, or do you view it as having a more strategic position in the world situation today and in the West today?
The question is, how do I regard Islam? Do I regard it as just one tribe amongst many, or does it have a significant position in the world? Is that roughly it? I must say I'm really confused. I thought I had a really clear view of this prior to September the 11th, in as much as I thought it would become, for vast swathes of former Soviet Europe, throughout Horn of Africa, etc., etc., that Islam would become resurgent. Now, there's a sense in which it's taken on the West, and so the battle lines have been drawn, you know, the jihad versus McWorld. I mean, it's never been more clear that our secular leaders are confused. Mr. Blair, for all his great attempts to make a coalition, because he's a liberal secular, he doesn't understand why people with the offer of democracy, you know, want to say, we hate it, we don't like it, we don't want it, because he just doesn't have the hinterland, he doesn't have the categories to begin to understand why that's going on. I do not think that for the ordinary Western European that Islam looks remotely plausible. But I think politically it will become very significant because of the bargains that's got to be made. I think it could become very dangerous because friendship will be made, continue to be made, with those Islamic nations who have, with whom the West want a good relationship, and they will, in order to stay in power, they will not allow a democracy to emerge, because right across, you know, the Middle East, we only have Turkey and Israel where there is democracy, and I suppose if you want an apocalyptic concern, the worry is that we have eventually some of these governments who are friends of the West, Islamic governments, who will have greater military capability, like Pakistan, who are vulnerable to being overrun by the masses, who have no allegiance, no love, no loyalty for their government. And I mean, you know, I don't want to talk about end game and all the rest of it, but I think there could be some huge significance there. But the battle with Islam hates God's Christ as much as any secular ideology, and whilst we must try and reach Muslims, knowing they're condemned to a lost eternity because of this great tyranny, so whilst there must be that pastoral response, I do believe that we do need to speak up, and it's very hard in a place like Oxford, England, and many other of our capital secular liberal cities to actually say the truth, to blow the whistle on what Islam stands for and where it wants to take the world. So I, as you can see, have a fairly hard-nosed view, but I think we've got to. And there's a situation where Amy is here to tell us that in Oxford, where we have liberal secular, if I can call it this, churches. I would call the university church in Oxford that on tape. But there's an appalling situation you need to pray for, Amy. Just broken.
I've got quite an interesting situation in Oxford. Recently, the Muslim chaplain to Oxford University came to give a presentation to a group called Churches Together, and he is proposing a code of conduct which he wants every university in England to take on as part of their MUS, which is basically a code of conduct for religious tolerance. And this code of conduct includes all kinds of different rules, one of which is that no university society should be allowed to have a doctrinal basis. And it specifically names UCCF, which is our Christian Union movement in England, along with groups like Al-Mahajirun, which is obviously in a very extreme Islamic group, as groups which should be outlawed on our university campuses. Now, one of the interesting things that has happened is that alongside this kind of move from Muslims, the Jewish society nationally, the Student Christian Movement, which is a liberal Christian organisation, and the Catholic Society are joining together, if you like, to endorse this proposal, which is to be taken to every student union in England. So it looks increasingly like evangelical Christians are going to be prevented from proclaiming the gospel on our campuses, in sort of as a name for tolerance, which is unbelievable. So if you can pray for us in that.
Yeah. It's the day we've all feared, many of us, for some time, but it seems to be coming. Have we time for another question, Stefan? I'm in your hands. Sorry, I've my blind spot over here.
Just a quick mention, there is a man in England, Anthony McCroy, who is an apologist within the Muslim community, and he's always with them, and he's dialoguing with them, and he's quite a good journalist. He's just gotten his doctorate, and he writes for their publications, and he's able to present the Christian answer to their thing, and they actually publish it in some of their...
Yes, I can enjoy. He recently came to the Oxford Union and it made some observations that were very helpful in an Islam debate. McCroy. Yeah, one more question. Is there anybody over here? Going? Yeah, final question.
Thank you for analyzing our situation. It was interesting for me that you didn't stop in analyzing the situation, that you... Well, sort of immediately want to give some approach. And I wonder why you did this. Because I think that maybe we have to stick sort of more with the analyzing. For example, the question, what makes people change their mind in general?
Mm.
So you talked about it in the part about the approaches, but I think it's more in place. And we analyze the situation. So why people...
Yeah, thank you. The point that's made is it was a session essentially about analysis, but after the analysis I was suggesting some response. I suppose that's the nature of me. I love reading David Wells and his analysis of society, but upon reading him I immediately am saying, but what is the response? What are the strategies? What must we do? And I think if there is a danger for an apologetics forum, it's that we'll develop great big fat files of analysis, and we are really going to be great at telling people the state of Europe and moment in time. But unless we keep reminding ourselves with every analysis the responsibility of that knowledge, that in knowing these things, how must we then live and speak and be? Unless we keep doing that, we'll become constipated with our analysis. And on that healthy lavatorial note.
This right now.